This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto, and for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking tuna. But not Charlie the tuna, not the kind you find in a can or in your tuna sandwich. We're going to be talking about the giant bluefin tuna. Marine scientists marvel at the bluefin's extraordinary qualities. It's a half-ton fish that can swim at highway speeds, and the bluefins can warm their bodies to 80 degrees in frigid waters. But sushi lovers prize the bluefin for its soft, buttery flesh, and this delicacy does not come cheap. Now, if you want to get into the bluefin tuna business, a single bluefin can command over $100,000. That's 100 grand for just one fish on the market. And so for fishermen, it's like winning the lottery each time they catch one fish. But experts say we may be eating the bluefin into extinction. Is there a way to have our fish and eat it too? Well, joining me now to talk about the bluefin tuna and its journey from the open ocean to the sushi bar is Richard Ellis, author of over a dozen books on the ocean and its inhabitants. And this new book is called Tuna, A Love Story. He's here with us in our New York studios. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Thank you.
It's an odd title to have a love story with a tuna.
It turns out that, everybody loves tuna for one reason or another.
I love it.
I love it. I love it. I have eaten tuna fish sandwiches
right.
and tuna salads. I've eaten bluefin tuna, as a matter of fact, but that comes later in the story. But I love it most because it is such an accomplished creature. It is beautiful. It's strong, it's fast, it's smart, it has modifications that exceed those of any other fish in the ocean. And I actually am also a painter. Hmm. And so what I do is I paint the things I admire. Other people shoot them, some people fish for them. I paint them. And so I've actually painted the jacket illustration for this
Beautiful.
Book. And I just think it is marvelous looking. So from one perspective anyway, I love the bluefin tuna. But everybody else does too, especially the Japanese who eat the fat belly meat of the bluefin tuna to such a degree that the fish itself is bordering on extinction.
Is that what we call turo?
It's called turo or maguro. Mm-hmm. It is only a certain part of the fatty belly meat of a bluefin tuna. And as you said before, bluefin tuna can weigh a half ton or more. So when you recognize that what they're eating is a very small proportion of the entire fish, it's conceivable that most of this fish is being wasted.
They throw out the rest of the fish?
They don't throw it out, but it isn't the high-level tuna that commands these bizarre prices.
Wow. Tell us a little bit about this fish. You say the fish can heat up its body to 80 degrees in 40-degree water?
Well, most fish, as everybody knows, are cold-blooded vertebrates. That means that their body temperature is the same as the environment in which they live. Codfish, say, living off the Grand Banks in 40-degree water, has a body temperature of 40 degrees. A butterfly fish living in the Caribbean next to a coral reef where the water temperature is 75 degrees will have a body temperature of 75 degrees. A bluefin tuna, on the other hand, living in, say, 40-degree water, can raise its body temperature to 80 degrees.
Wow.
It has a complex series of countercurrent exchangers in its circulatory system that warm up its muscles. Just think of an athlete warming up, but a tuna, a bluefin tuna, is always warmed up.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is more competent than the fish it's chasing. It can swim faster than most things in the ocean. Tuna have been clocked at 55 miles an hour. They can catch anything that swims.
Right.
Except perhaps a sailfish, which can swim 68 miles an hour, but that's all spines and pointy bits, and
right.
I wouldn't want to eat those anyway. So here's this creature that has all these marvelous modifications. It fins can be made flush with its body. They tuck into slots. Its eyes are flush with its body.
It's the perfect, not aerodynamically.
Hydrodynamic
fish.
At MIT, they decided to try and figure out whether or not they could power boats by some means other than the circulating propeller. And since a tuna, this hydrodynamic marvel, wags its tail to move, they built a robo-tuna. They built a fish that wagged its tail, and they thought, well, maybe we can apply this to ships. Maybe this is the best way to go. It turns out that they failed to replicate the speed or the hydrodynamic capabilities of the tuna, and they gave up. The tuna is better at what it does than MIT could possibly create.
Wow. 1-800-989-8255. Talking Tuna with Richard Ellis, author of Tuna, A Love Story. Let's talk about the life cycle of a tuna.
Tuna, first of all, female tuna lay anywhere from 1 million to 3 million eggs. They need to be a certain age and a certain size before they spawn, and that, too, comes later in the story. A tuna, when it's born, is about the size of a grain of rice. It increases in size, assuming it gets to its full size. It increases in size 1 billion times. It goes through obvious growth stages. Mm-hmm. There are smaller ones until they get to be large ones. They feed on various things in the ocean. And for the most part, when a tuna is the size of a grain of rice or the size of, say, your little finger, most things feed on them.
Yeah.
So laying 1 million eggs doesn't mean you're going to get 1 million tuna.
Right.
It means that some very small percentage will survive.
I've seen Wild Kingdom. I know how that works.
The little ones become part of the plankton, and everything eats little tiny things in the ocean. They eventually get to be a full size, which can, in the bluefin tuna can be anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 pounds.
And when we catch them out at sea, how are they caught? They're in this size range.
Well, they're caught in many, many different ways. Off New England, they are harpooned.
Really?
Yeah.
They're that big, you use a harpoon on them.
Well, because it's illegal to catch them any other way off New England.
I see.
In other parts of the world, like the Mediterranean and Australia, they catch them in huge purse seines, and they draw these purses closed, and they catch thousands and thousands of fish at a time. But off New England, it looks kind of like a miniature whaling vessel.
Right.
It has a big
pulpit
in the front, and a man is standing there with a harpoon. They spot a tuna, and they drive after it, and the guy throws the harpoon, and they pull in one fish at a time.
And in the Mediterranean, how do they get them back here? When you
first we have to catch them in the Mediterranean, and this is probably the major problem with tuna. First of all, the Mediterranean is a breeding ground for the Atlantic bluefin tuna. Second of all, for several thousand years, people have been fishing for bluefin in the Mediterranean. Early on, they fished for them in what was called a matanza, where they had a series of ever-decreasing nets where the fish would be guided into the final net where they'd then be hauled up and stabbed or hacked to death. This is virtually extinct now, this method of fishing, been replaced by big purse seines where they spot them from the air. They spot huge schools from the air. They surround them in the purse seine. They purse the net closed. They tow this whole net full of fish. There can be thousands of fish. They tow this whole net full of fish to a floating pen. They put the tuna in this pen. They feed them for
How long a distance do they tow them?
Well, in the Mediterranean, they could tow them 5 or 10 miles.
Because
they know where to fish for them.
Right,
I mean, because they see them from the air, or they're spotted from the air. Then they put them in these pens, and they fatten them up. They feed them fish. Tuna don't eat fish food that you could buy in your pet store and sprinkle in the pen. So you have to have fish for the tuna. So in other words, we're catching fish to feed the fish. And of course, the
fish.
It's
like a tuna ranch.
It is.
They're ranching tuna.
It's a feedlot mentality, in fact. And they fatten them up, and then they kill them, and then they ship them all to Japan. Every single country in or on the Mediterranean, Spain, France, Italy, Greece, Croatia, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, Libya, they're all doing this. And because they're all doing it, and because the controls of this fishery are lax, there is something called ICAT, the International Convention for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas, and it puts out quotas. Mm-hmm. And the Libyan fishermen and the Spanish fishermen and the French say, thank you very much, and they go right on fishing for tuna because the market in Japan is so intense.
1-800-989-8255. Alan in Merle's Inlet, South Carolina. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I had a question for the author about that very issue, about other cheating, other countries cheating on the international limit for bluefin tuna, and what can be done to curb Japan's apparently insatiable appetite for this?
Well, those are two different questions. The cheating problem is almost impossible to stop. The World Wildlife Fund has recently called for a cessation of all tuna fishing in the Mediterranean. Even with that, even having called for that, that doesn't make it happen. Mm-hmm. And so they're still fishing because, now this gets to the second part of your question, because the Japanese market still exists. And the Japanese have what actually amounts to nothing but a fad. I mean, they don't need this. It's not particularly nourishing. They think it's particularly delicious. And so they want as many bluefin tuna as they can get. In Tokyo, at the Tsukiji Fish Market, every single day, they bring in thousands and thousands of tuna. And I've been there, and I've photographed the fish market. And as you look at this, it's not only tuna in this fish market. It's everything that ever swam in the ocean. And as you look at it, you think to yourself, they must have vacuumed up the whole ocean. There can't be anything left. And yet the next day you go back and it's just like it was that day before with thousands of tuna lined up in rows. And these are the famous tuna auctions where one tuna was once auctioned off for $173,000.
Just for the little part of that tuna?
No, the whole fish. The whole fish. It was a 440-pound fish and it was bought. Well, you know,
but really, they were looking for that fatty part of the fish.
Yeah, well, what they do at these auctions is they walk around and there's a piece of skin peeled back and they feel the meat with their fingers to see what the fat content is. They smell it, and since they're going to eat it raw, they taste it. And this fish, or the $173,000 fish, was so perfect from the standpoint of the buyer that he was willing, and this is an auction, so somebody bid $100,000, somebody bid $125,000. It's in Japanese. They're not really bidding in dollars. But the fact is that it ended up being sold for $173,000 because this man believed that when it was cut up into bite-sized pieces, as it were, people would spend $100 a piece for one of these pieces. So the fish that was sold for $173,000 probably ended up being a $500,000 fish by the time it got to the table.
It's a $5,000 bite.
Yeah.
The taste of the fish. Let's go to Judy in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine.
Hey, I've been to that market. I was telling the gal when I called in, it is amazing to see the amount of fish that there is out there that people, I mean, it's amazing to think that people have got to have the bluefin, because I was born and raised in Japan, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, but, you know, and so I've eaten Japanese food my entire life, and I rarely eat the toro or the maguro because of the fact that there's clams to eat, etc., and on the rare occasions I do, the sushi guy that I go to, who's, you know, from Japan, he'll go, hey, I've got in some buri, which is also fatty belly, or the toro, you ought to try some. It's really outstanding. And it's this pale, pale pink. It almost looks like you're eating a piece of beef. And it is very buttery. I mean, granted, it is really, really good. But, you know, when there are other things out there that I think just as good, I mean, you know, the stuff that's like a halibut or, you know, the different clams, like the gooey duck clam, the mirugai, and different clams, akagai, and all these different kinds of clams that maybe Americans aren't necessarily aware of that they should try. And, of course, there's always, my kids are like in their 30s now, and they know about the gaijin rolls. Gaijin means foreigner in Japanese. And the gaijin rolls, like the Philadelphia roll, where you get the cream cheese and the, I mean, it's
all right,
it's,
you know, all right, Judy, we get the point. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. Have a good weekend.
Bye.
1-800-989-8255. Talking with Richard Ellis, author of Tuna, a Love Story on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And lots to talk about. Why can't we just farm the fish? Why can't we make a pen? You know, if they're being taken to a pen, why can't we make big fish farms?
We can. Well, it's been done. The Japanese tried to do it for obvious reasons. And they succeeded in raising a handful of fish to market size. The European fishery is so intense that it isn't really necessary for the Japanese to do this. On the other hand, in Australia, in South Australia, there is a company called Clean Seas, which is a fish farming organization. They have successfully raised yellowfin and another fish, I can't remember the name of it, but they raise them in large tanks. And they, this year, in fact, in the calendar year of 08, they succeeded for the first time anywhere in getting bluefin tuna to breed in captivity. When I was in South Australia, I went to research this book. I went to South Australia last year. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I saw the facility. I saw this giant tank that they'd built, which they can control the temperature and the light level to fool the fish into thinking they're in Indonesian waters and at the right time of year, because tuna breed only once a year. At the right time of year, the tuna were supposed to say, oh, good, let's have some babies now, dear. But in fact, they failed last year. And so I finished writing the book last year, except that this year in March, they succeeded. And what they've done is they fooled the tuna. In other words, the tuna spawn, they've got these little tiny fry, and they're trying to raise them. Now, it'll be years before these tuna can be raised to market size, so it's impossible to say that this experiment has succeeded. But there's no reason why it shouldn't, because these people know what they're doing, and they know how to raise these fish. And so, therefore, it is possible that this event in South Australia, which occurred in March of 08, will change the equation completely. It might not change it for the better, but it will change it completely because there will be something that can compete with the European fishery. Mm-hmm. And it's conceivable, well, not these people didn't go into it to save the tuna. Right. They went into it to make money. But if you can create a whole lot of saleable tuna without having to go fish for them and shoot them in the head and whatever else you have to do, then you change the balance completely, and it's possible.
They've shown that you can do it. They probably have a trade secret, I imagine.
Well, when I went there, they were very careful to tell me no photograph. I couldn't even photograph the place from outside. I don't know why. They thought maybe I was going to sell the technology to the Japanese or the Koreans. But in fact, I saw it. I saw all these pumps. I had no idea what they did.
Right.
And I saw this huge tank, and we fed the fish from in this huge tank. And they're giant fish. They're 700-800 pound fish that they, in fact, have raised from wild fish that they caught in the ocean.
Wow. We're talking with Richard Ellis, author of Tuna, A Love Story. We're going to have to take a short break. We'll come back and talk lots more with Richard and also talk about an attempt to track the tuna around the oceans and maybe find a way to save them from extinction that way with our taste for sushi. It's getting worse out there. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Myra Flato. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Myra Flato. We're talking about bluefin tuna. This is a fish I think most people have seen either as sushi or sashimi in their local sushi bar. Talking with Richard Ellis, author of Tuna, A Love Story. And our next guest has seen these massive tuna out at sea, and she's tagged hundreds of them with small computers to track their movements around the world, and hopefully that research could help us in bluefin conservation efforts. And Barbara Block is the professor in marine sciences at Stanford University's Hopkins Marine Station in Pacific Grove, California. She's on the phone today from a conference where there are hundreds of scientists gathered to talk about tracking methods of all creatures, penguins, whales, elephant seals, and of course, bluefin tuna. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Block.
Hello. Glad to be there.
How is tagging going to help us conserve tuna?
Well, our team has actually put over 2,000 tags in tunas in several oceans, and the tags help us find out where tunas go when they're beneath the sea. So for all of mankind, or for all of time, we haven't been able to actually track tunas beneath the sea very well.
We don't know where they come and go?
Well, we didn't until recently, and so what we've been doing is we have two types of archival or data logger tags that are similar to taking, if you will, an IBM laptop, throwing it inside your local tuna and then letting them go again. So these tunas have been carrying around these tags, and they're actually running a 17th century algorithm on a 21st century tag. They're measuring sunrise and sunset, and from sunrise and sunset, we can actually figure out the longitude and latitude of where the tuna is while they're beneath the sea.
How do you tag a tuna?
Well, what we do is we go out to places like the coast of North Carolina, down near Morehead City. We're about to go up to Canada. And we work with fishers. They're the best at finding out where the tunas are. The tuna actually is caught on hook and line with a hook that's a special type of hook called a circle hook. We can pull a tuna as large as 1,100 to 1,200 pounds even into a boat, de-hook the tuna, put a hose in the mouth to keep the oxygen flowing over its gills, and then we quickly either put an external tag on that's called a pop-up satellite archival tag, or we do a quick surgery with a local anesthetic where we're able to stick a archival tag, this little IBM-like computer, inside the tuna. I should say it's more like an iPhone in terms of its memory. Mm-hmm. And then the tag has an external sensor that senses the marine environment around the tuna. We let it go, and then we tag the outside of the tuna with a simple spaghetti tag that says, if you find me, it's colored green, we'll give you a big reward to get the tag back.
Richard Ellis, ever seen a tagged tuna?
Sure.
Yeah?
Sure. First of all, let me say hello to Barbara. And I think what she has done and is doing is one of the most important biological experiments being done, because it is giving us knowledge that we never had before, that we never could have mm-hmm. before, and the ability to tag and follow tuna and understand where they go. This also clocks their depth. We know that tuna now can dive to 3,000 feet at the same time with monitoring their body
wow.
temperature. So I think what she's doing is great.
I think it's great you're there, and I'm glad you're on the show, and thanks for welcoming me. It turns out they can dive to deeper than that depth. So
wow.
is actually, they've hit our limits of 2,000 meters or 6,000 feet, and it's a remarkable story. And I've been at a conference this week of all the biologgers in the globe. We had 20 nations, about 90 species being discussed, and gadgets were being put on a whole lot of animals, and we're opening up the mystery of our undersea world wow. with these same electronics that allow us to talk to satellites on our telephones. We're actually able with a
wow.
memory to get lots of information.
Does the tuna have to surface so that it hits the satellite?
Well, on the tunas, we're using two types of tags. So one tag is a recorder, so a data logger, and it's actually just taking data, archiving it,
I see.
And we don't get it back until a fisherman catches that same tuna a second time.
Does he get a bounty for catching that tuna?
They get a reward for catching the tuna and returning the tag. So we have lots of tags coming back to us in the Atlantic. Probably at this point, 30 nations have returned 20% of the tags we've put in the ocean of the archival type. In the Pacific, a whopping 50% of the tunas we tag have had their archival tags returned by about three nations.
And what do you give, what $500, something
we
like?
We give them back $500 in the Pacific and actually $1,000 huh. in the Atlantic because they're a rarer find. The second type of tag we use is a pop-up satellite tag, and it combines the brains, if you will, the controller of the archival tag, but it's put on the outside of the fish, and on a given day, it could be your birthday, we program it to come up, and what happens is a stainless steel pin corrodes through electrolysis. The tag floats to the surface with a syntactic foam, comes up to the surface, and then transmits its data to an Earth-orbiting satellite.
Wow.
It's like having your tuna phone home.
And you learn, I mean, I can't believe 6,000 feet a diving tuna. I mean, that, how does it, you know, they ask, it begs all those same questions we wonder about seals and other animals that can dive so deeply and not be affected by the bends and things like that.
Right. Well, fish are breathing with gills, so
yeah.
they're not taking a packet of air inside them, such as in their lungs.
Mm. But
in the story of the tunas, what's remarkable is they go down,
pressure.
They spend time in waters as cool as ice water, and then they actually come back to the surface quite fast.
And they don't get squozen down there by all that water pressure?
No, actually, they're sort of incompressible because they, too, are sort of a fluid, and without having lungs, it isn't as much of a problem.
Wow.
So some of the big picture questions for bluefin is that they're warm-bodied, as Richard said. They get to be as warm as about 85 to 88 degrees inside. They actually have hearts that are exposed to the cold water, so the real conundrum of tuna biology, if you will, when we're trying to figure out how they work, is that their hearts are actually delivering blood to a warm body, and the warm body mm-hmm. screams for more oxygen and more energy, mm-hmm. and the heart actually can function over a much wider temperature range than our mammal heart.
Let's go to Jonah in Queens, New York. Hi, Jonah.
Hi, thanks for having me. Two-part question. How did tuna originally get to have the appeal that it does, and is it only expensive now because it's rare?
When did sushi first start? Has it been in the Japanese diet forever?
Well, you would think so, but in fact, it's a relatively recent innovation, because up until the Second World War, there were no such thing as home freezers or even much in the way of refrigerators in Japan. It was only after the war, when refrigerators and freezers were introduced, that the Japanese could freeze fish. Prior to that, they smoked fish, or they pickled it, or they dried it. But the introduction of the refrigerators in the 1960s enabled them to freeze it and therefore store it for time and then introduce sushi. So sushi, this whole thing that you tend to believe the Japanese have been eating forever, only began around the 1960s. And just think of this for a moment. Now we can say the word sushi and sashimi on the air here, and everybody says, oh yeah, I love that, my favorite Japanese restaurant is. But 40 years ago, even 30 years ago, most Americans, foremost Americans, the idea of eating a piece of raw fish was nigh on to disgusting. Nobody wanted to eat raw fish. The Japanese started it. They exported the technology. They exported the menus. And all of a sudden, it's become this enormously popular, enormously expensive thing.
Mm-hmm. And Barbara, what other kinds of research do you want to learn? I mean, you've learned how deep these tuna can dive. What other things do you hope to learn from tagging these fish?
Well, here at Stanford and with the Monterey Bay Aquarium, we have sort of two programs. One is that we actually keep tunas. I heard the discussion about Clean Seas where I had visited this year, too. We actually have a land-based facility that's been operational since 1994, and we actually are learning about the tunas as Olympians in our land-based facility. They're one of the greatest athletes in the world, and from the tagging studies, what we've learned is a single tuna, no bigger than 30 pounds, can actually swim across the Pacific and back three times in the mission on its tag.
Wow.
So most of us would go into the cold water of Monterey Bay and not get very far, but the tunas and their warm-bodied sort of missile shape are able to actually power themselves efficiently across the ocean. And we're learning where are their corridors, where are the foraging grounds that might be equivalent to the watering holes of the African plains, where are the savannas that they're feeding on. And for all of these areas that are sort of out of sight and out of mind when we're talking about the ocean, the tags are sort of giving us that view.
Too bad you can't train a tuna, because then you could put it in, you know, with one of these aquariums where they can train a tuna.
Well, you can't.
Why would you want to eat something that's, you know, doing all kinds of flips and swirls and things like that?
People do that all the time. Yeah. People watch horses and cows and things jumping around. But one of the interesting things is, while you don't necessarily train them very well, at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, there's what's called the Outer Bay Tank, which is this giant tank, this million-gallon tank. It's bigger, actually, than the tank at Clean Seas, where they're breeding them. At the Monterey Bay Aquarium, they have bluefin and yellowfin tuna swimming around. And for me, at any rate, you asked me earlier why I love the tuna. I can stand in front of that tank for hours at a time. That's, in fact, the tank where they now, today, have the fourth young great white shark. And it draws great crowds to look at this mini Jaws. Mm-hmm. But most of the fish in the tank are bluefin and yellowfin tuna, and it is breathtaking, for some of us anyway, to watch them in that tank. And I've stood there for hours and watched them, and you can see them circling relatively slowly. Tuna have to keep moving. You've heard about sharks. Well, it doesn't always work for sharks, but it certainly always works for tuna. If you trap a tuna in a net and it can't keep swimming, it will drown. But I will watch them, and Barbara has a much better opportunity when she's not at sea, because she's a lot closer to the Monterey Bay Aquarium than I am, although I'm going to be there in October. The fact is that I watch them, and I watch them circling, and suddenly, bang, a fish that used to be there isn't there anymore because, for reasons known only to this tuna, it accelerates instantaneously. And you think, wait a minute, this can't be happening. I was just looking at that fish. It's not here anymore, because they are so powerful and so fast. And I love the description of them as being Olympic athletes, because they're better at what they do than any other fish.
Barbara, are you as passionate about tuna as Richard is?
Well, I'm sure. I think that we'd be in the same ballpark. So Stanford and Monterey Bay Aquarium working together has brought this view of bluefin as well as the white shark that we can see today at the Monterey Bay Aquarium in their slice of the open sea. And now millions of people can come by and see the beauty of the color, the form, and the gorgeous way that they swim, because we have this open sea tank that we've helped with the science and the aquarium with their tremendous knowledge of animal husbandry together, put together.
Talking about tuna this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Richard Ellis, author of Tuna, A Love Story, and also with Barbara Block. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Amy in Chandler, Arizona.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have two quick questions. I was curious, as far as the farm-raised tuna, if there is good to eat. Because my experience with salmon, all the farm-raised salmon from I guess the Atlantic are near as good. I'm originally from Alaska, and from what I've heard, that they actually pump red food dye coloring in the farm-raised because they don't eat the natural crustaceans that actually turn them. You know, same as the flamingos. That's how they get their color. And the other quick question was, as far as their body temperature, are they actually warm-blooded or can get up to 80, 85, 88 degrees? Because
We're running out of time.
For the pure fact of being able to swim very fast. Mm-hmm.
Richard, do you have any answers about the food?
Well, the first question, answer, is that they haven't succeeded in raising farm-raised tuna yet, so we don't know how they're going to taste. I can't answer how they do taste or how they're going to taste. As far as the second question is concerned, they are essentially warm-blooded fishes. They're not mammals. They're fishes, and this doesn't define, because they breathe with gills. They breathe water, after all. That doesn't make them mammals. They are able, by the way, to raise and lower their temperature at will. They're not always swimming at 88 degrees. If it's not necessary, they can lower their body temperature, which is itself a miracle and something to marvel at.
Right. So, Barbara, what would you like to know about the tuna that you don't know yet?
Oh, that's a tough question. What would I like to know? We don't know enough about when and where they spawn. Mm-hmm. And critical to protecting the remaining bluefin tuna in the Atlantic Ocean is really pinpointing the whole story of when a giant bluefin tuna literally has sex. So we're real interested in knowing where is the spawning occurring, when is it occurring, and how then we can actually protect these spawning aggregations so that bluefin tomorrow are here on Earth.
Richard, what would you like to know?
I would like to know that the bluefin tuna is safe. I would like to know that this marvelous creature is not the subject of a insane Japanese fad to eat them out of existence. I would like there to be a device, whether it is a conservation device or a scientific device, some way of assuring that my grandchildren will be able to see bluefin tuna. I don't care whether they eat them or not, but see them.
Is this the same tuna that we pedestrians eat in the sushi shop?
No, what you eat
in... It's a different kind of tuna. I want to make that clear to our listeners.
What you eat in the sushi shop, even if it's reddish in color, is yellowfin or big-eye tuna. Bluefin tuna, by and large, makes its way almost entirely to Japan.
That's that fatty type of fish that we don't see very often. Well, good luck to you, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. Richard Ellis, author of Tuna, A Love Story. And to you too, Barbara Block. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
She's the Charles and Elizabeth Prothrow Professor in Marine Sciences at Stanford University's Hopkins Marine Station in Pacific Grove, California. That's about all the time we have for this week. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Kim Molesky. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We've got those new videos up this week. A great one about the butterflies whose eyes shine in the dark. You'll want to see that one. Also, you can send us email there or send us regular mail at Science Friday for West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. And also, we're blogging and podcasting there. You can download all our video and audio podcasts. Have a great week. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.